SCP-001 Black Adytum Part 2. In Part 1 of this dark story, we learned that the Sarkiks are currently just one small tribe with no memories of their grand past of being the Nalka. They are led by Grand Karsist Ayun, who curiously is in the form of a young girl, and more curiously, has no memory of her past either. With the involvement of a Foundation android, they uncovered a burial site beneath the tribe, where Ayun consumed the heart of one of her clavigars, Nadak, discovering that the fall of Black Adytum seemed to have rested on her shoulders. Now, Nadak has bid her to gather up the bones of all her clavigars to take them to be buried in the city, so that she can know herself and be forgiven, walking the path of the bone. Let's continue. We move on to Chapter 2 of the article, The Reliquary of Sa'arn, which begins with the fourth truth of Ayun. It reads, "All evil lives in the space between slaver and slave, king and commoner, God and creation. Evil can only be destroyed when this space is turned to nothing, when the whip is broken and the crown is shattered and the god is brought low, when all are as one." In the weeks following the discovery of the underground cavern beneath the Sarkic encampment, many of the texts from the archive of Nadak were digitized and uploaded to Foundation databases for translation. Progress was slowed by the sheer quantity of texts, numbering in the thousands, but Grand Karsist Ayun displayed a newfound recollection of the fundamentals of the Nalkan language. The language has linguistic roots in Davite, while the modern pidgin the Sarkiks speak is a highly simplified dialect with equal influence from Jin Chinese and Mongolian, being almost unrecognizable as the same language. The texts were arranged in roughly chronological order, and translation efforts prioritized the more recent and less damaged texts. We're given an excerpt from the final chapter of the Record of Ayun, which reads, "In the midst of the destruction of Adytum, the Clavigars gathered their few possessions, for they had given up everything in service of the Witch King. Sa'arn slipped his blades away from the armory, silent while the war drums pounded through the city. Urak claimed her armor from the garrison, allowing no one to halt her. Lovatar drifted into the catacombs under the temple to take the seed they treasured more than anything else. And then they went into the streets, loud with the shouting of armies and the clashing of metal, to gather their most loyal followers and whisper they must leave. And when it was all complete, they massed in the oldest tunnel in Adytum, for it had let the first Nalka into the city, and now it would lead the last Nalka out. The Clavigars were confused, for where they had brought only the simplest possessions, Nadak stood with 10 books clasped in each hand. 'You will slow our escape,' Sa'arn hissed. 'We will be killed like all the other believers.' The others agreed, but Nadak raised a hand. 'We will escape. We will be free. But our children and our children's children and their children too must know who we were. For if we lose sight of who we are, what we have escaped, we are no one at all.' And the other Clavigars agreed, for they did not want their story to be lost. And so they took Nadak's texts, and in the dead of night, while their city rocked back and forth in throes, the Clavigars escaped the destruction of Adytum." Later, Xenophon approaches Ayun on a hill overlooking the Sarkic encampment, which is in the process of being broken down by Foundation security personnel. Xenophon takes a seat next to her, seeing her cradling a small bird with a bent wing in her hands. It comments that the camp has nearly been disassembled, and that Karsist Yeva is displeased, but she just replies that Yeva will live. Xenophon asks her if she is certain that this is the best course of action, to which she says that it is the only course of action. It says that they have offered to take her and a small group to the location given by Nadok, which would be substantially simpler and faster than this, but she says that she has lived this way for 100 years, so she has a shortage of answers, not of time. Xenophon comments that she risks disturbing her people, and after a brief moment, she asks it its thoughts on prayer. Xenophon replies with a couple of textbook definitions of prayer, but she says that a prayer is given meaning by the one praying. All of their prayers come from her memory, and the meanings are half remembered. She asked one of the young boys in the camp what he thought prayer meant, and he brightly told her that they were asking her for good fortune, as he thought that she was their god. Xenophon remarks that children struggle to understand complex ideas, as the boy has only seen her leading the tribe his whole life. Ayun, however, says that it is not just the children, and at times, she had no idea what she was preaching. Now that she can understand the old words again, she's been thinking of the prayers, and things are muddy, but she can remember the earliest sermons now. They said that the gods are unreliable, that to pray to a being is to make it your master, and that humanity must become the masters of ourselves if we wish to be free. The boy had asked her who their god was, and she could not answer him. She has attempted for so long to keep their course steady, but it's time to admit that she has no more idea of who they are and who they were than the boy does. They will walk the path and find out who they were, but she is not their master. They were nomads once, and together they have chosen to be again. Xenophon says that the council will be in command of this mission, acting through it, and they have negotiated the free passage of the tribe through northern China and Mongolia. If they need to journey farther than that, they'll have to reassess, but she cannot see where the path ends, only where to go next. She has indicated a location almost 150 kilometers away, which will take them around 2 weeks on foot. The Foundation can provide food, water, and medical assistance, but in exchange, they will be accompanied by a Foundation military escort, and any locations, objects, or persons of interest they encounter will be under Foundation custody. Ayun is expected to maintain regular interviews with itself or an authorized Foundation psychiatrist, and at any point, the Foundation may terminate this initiative. Ayun agrees to the terms, and Xenophon comments on her being very cooperative. She doesn't respond at first, tightening her hands and whispering something as the bird in her hand flaps one wing in distress. The blood congeals around the other wing into new flesh, and she releases it, allowing it to glide away with its wound healed. She smiles and tells Xenophon that she's not cooperative, just desperate. Accompanied by a detachment from MTF New 7, the Black Adytum Initiative departed from the tribal territory on December 23, 2041, the group totaling 187 people. We're then provided an update from Delta Zero, indicating that Project Locust personnel continue to follow the suspected route of the Black Star entity through Central Asia. They are currently located in a province in China where several archaeological sites indicate the passage of a large army, with unearthed artifacts including iron swords that are visually consistent with descriptions of the three-prong army provided by researcher Pandora Galanis, currently missing in action. Their current path is believed to continue southwest towards the Caspian Sea. The Black Adytum Initiative Party has crossed 25 kilometers from their departure point, and embedded agents report slight tension between the Sarkic tribesfolk and security personnel. This is a predicted response, so intervention is unnecessary, and Xenophon.aic appears to be fully cooperative and operating within expected margins. The individual messaging Xenophon in the present notes that it's interesting that Project Locust is tracking where the three-prong army went after the Nalka. They mention that Xenophon had said it knew nothing about Project Locust, and it states that it did not submit this update to the file. The Black Adytum Initiative did not include members from MTF Delta Zero, and it then checks the task force directory, noting that there is no Delta Zero listed, even though it appears that they were surveilling the group. The individual remarks that it looks like the Council didn't trust it as much as it thought. The Black Adytum Initiative continued to make slow progress up the border of China and Mongolia, as the Sarkites had considerable reservations about traveling at night. During these nights, Xenophon would interview the Grand Karsist regarding her gradually clearing memories. She recalls that Nadok was the first of her clavigars, a word meaning the ones you choose to share your flesh and blood with, unlike family. Nadok was the first of her clavigars when the war began, not the one with the trees and the machines that came later, but the war against the old masters, the hated Deva. Those who brought their fathers and them here from far away, aboard their great ships, to dig, to build their great city for them. There were thousands of slaves, far more than the masters, but they had magic, and the slaves had nothing but their bodies. No names, no power, until they found the mangled god, the old beast, Yaldabaoth. That part of her memory is blurred and unclear, but it was a god, and it spoke to her, and she supped on its flesh. She remembers feeding her clavigars, giving them names and taking one of her own, and she remembers the bloodshed after. Nadok was the wisest among them, and he had stolen the knowledge of the old masters, being blinded for it. He had no talent for flesh crafting, so she held him in her arms and gave him 10 eyes from which to read the truth of the world, and 10 arms from which to enact it. He opened his 10 eyes and told her that they could not be the ones to begin this struggle if they wanted their brothers and sisters by their sides. She had no want to see blood spilt, so she preached in the farthest corners of Adytum in birth, where the slave driver's gazes did not penetrate. She preached to crowds of her fellow slaves, with Nadok and her clavigars by her side. At first, only a few, but when she healed the injuries that the whips and beatings had left on them, the severed fingers and toes, and made them stronger than they had been before, the stories spread like fire through the camp. Nadok told them her vision. No gods, no masters, that they would be free. When the old masters heard of the scarred lay preacher, they clapped chains around her neck, dragging her to the highest hill in Adytum. They beat her with clubs for 3 days and 3 nights. They broke every bone in her body, bled her dry, and raised the executioner's axe. When he brought down the blade, and it bent around her bone, she smiled and told him that she would still preach. She saw the fear in his dog eyes and knew then that they would be free. Nadok was invaluable in the uprising, listening to the slave masters and learning where they stored their grain, their weapons, and war beasts. Their storehouses were burned, their weapons seized, and their beasts slaughtered. She sat in her tent, burning the bones, seeing the future become more and more clear. Nadok knew how to halt the hated priestess's magic, to still the marching trees that slaughtered their Nalka. When the Deva pulled back into the core of Adytum, and their furious masses surrounded the walls, Nadok was next to her, translating her words into their language. They offered them peace, a future alongside them, and she remembered the priestess's words, spat with such disgust at Nadok's feet. She said that a slave will always be a slave, and they will always be their masters. She told them to bow, that they might show them mercy. Ayun did not bow, but she didn't lower her hand. Her Nalka buzzed, eager for vengeance, but she did not want blood to be shed. So Nadok turned to her, telling her that there are always those who will oppose a new world. There are always masters who will never give up their slaves. There will always be those who loathe the equality she brings. They have no place in their adytum. And so she lowered her hand, and her clavigars rushed forth, army of slaves behind them. For 3 days and 3 nights, the canals of adytum flowed with blood. She stripped and bathed in it, bidding this blood to wash away the sins of this city and be the blood of the womb from which their new world is born. Xenophon asks her if the name adytum means anything, and she smiles, replying that it means perfect city. Meanwhile, the translation efforts from the archive of Nadok continued, with digital copies of the translations being transmitted to Xenophon, who elected to share them with Ayun in the interest of further clarifying her memories. We're provided an excerpt from the Truths of Ayun, which reads, "Lo, gaze upon me, you slight, you frail. Gaze upon my form, skinned cheeks giving way to naked muscle, giving way to dripping blood, giving way to white bones. Gaze upon me, and know that the sacrifice I make is one in the name of my people, my subjects. You cry out for me to come back to you. You cry out for me to leave the tunnels and tombs and catacombs of this city, and to return to the surface where you may see me. And I choose not the life of attending to this mausoleum. Fate has chosen it for me, and I am but fate's slave. We are all but fate's slave. But I return, bringing you revelations torn from the lips of gods. And you whisper, because there are no gods in adytum. I have told you this. And you are right. No gods and no masters. There is only humanity in adytum. Look around you, assembled masses. Look around you, ye faithful. Look and tell me what you see. Tell me if you see one among you who resembles an outsider, a common man, those not from our Nalka. One who has not been altered by our arts, given more eyes or arms, or transformed into a being of power. Let him rise from his bow to me if he is present. He is not present. We have given up the humanity in our bodies for something greater. There are no crippled in this adytum. There are no blind in this adytum. We have given up our humanity, and we become greater and stronger for it. Many of you ask where the adytum you were promised is, and the answer is that you withhold it from yourself. You give up your humanity to weave your flesh, and you cling to the humanity in your soul. Our humanity must be overcome. It is not that there are no gods in adytum. It is that we are all gods. But divinity and humanity are as fire and ice, as peace and war. The war we find ourselves in now comes from those obsessed with their own humanity. Our enemies thirst to see us submitting to our own faults. We can do so no more. We must accept our divinity, and in doing so, relinquish our humanity. For its weakness lies in this, our obsession with the wellness of our enemies. The Holocausts come back from the front, wounded and dying, and we must raise them to fight again. Our humanity must be overcome. And this cannot be achieved by yourself. Your human self holds your divine self as its slave, and you must help me in letting you free yourself. For I have done it. I have overcome it and achieved my fullest potential. I walk in the footsteps of gods now, and you must follow me. Humanity keeps you tethered to this infirmity, but I have learned how to cut these chains, as I learned to cut the chains held by the old masters. Obey me, and take your divinity, as I have taken mine. In the process of building a better understanding of Sarkic culture and identity, Xenophon and several others were permitted to converse with Sarkite volunteers regarding tribal identity. Initial volunteers were few, owing to many of the Sarkites' discomfort with Xenophon. A 42-year-old weaver is asked what being Sarkic means to her, and she replies that it means family. These people are her family, the same souls that walked together 1,000 years ago, consumed and changed and reborn 10,000 times over. She held her son after he was born, and he suckled from her breast, and she felt the love pool in her heart because she knew she had held him like this in countless lifetimes. Even those that dislike her are her family, as they were her friends, her lovers, her parents, her children once. She makes them who they are, and they make her who she is. Along the trip, the group takes the form of a wagon train several hundred meters long, with foundation transports making up the front and rear and interspersed between. Xenophon walks near Ayun and Zhang, both on horseback, while Yeva sits in the back of a wagon nearby. Zhang comments on his horse being uncomfortable, to which Ayun replies that she doesn't appreciate being told that from such an inexperienced rider. Zhang apologizes, but Xenophon remarks that they would be making substantially better time if they utilized the Foundation vehicles. Zhang says that they wouldn't want to frighten or alarm her people, as he's sure that most of them aren't terribly familiar with vehicles, but Ayun says that they do have tractors, causing him to awkwardly back out of the conversation to go check about some solar panels. Xenophon asks Ayun if she's alright, but she says that she's angry, not at Zhang, but at herself. She cannot imagine herself speaking the way that these translated works state that she spoke back then, or behaving like that towards her people. Xenophon asks if it's possible that the translations are inaccurate, and she says that she thought they were. She grew angry at the Foundation for misleading her, asking for the untranslated copies, but after reading them, she saw that they were correct. The records say that she said these things and did these things. Xenophon counters that religious records are often distorted by time, but Ayun says that she has the memories. She remembers standing on the highest pulpit in Black Adytum, addressing an endless crowd of her people, with the amber sky casting rays down on the Holocaust, as she told them that they needed to bow to her as their god. Xenophon asks what Holocaust means, to which she explains it means army, and it says that assuming the memories are reliable, this would have occurred over 3,000 years ago. She can hardly be expected to answer for it now, but she says that there is no one left to answer for it but her. She cannot understand why she would have done this, or how, to which Xenophon asks her why. She turns to it, angry, and it apologizes, merely suggesting that interrogating as to why this offends her may be productive in determining how it happened. Neither speak for several minutes, until a small child approaches Ayun's horse while they're marching. He's holding his left hand in his right, and whispers something in the Sarkic pidgin. She smiles and hoists him up onto the saddle, seeing that there is an ugly gash in his left palm. She clucks in concern and grips the palm tightly, whispering over it. As she releases it, the blood congeals, scabbing over with new, raw skin. He whispers something into her ear, and she assures him that it won't. He looks unsure, and she rests a hand against his head, whispering something back before lowering him to the ground. She tells Xenophon that he was asking for a blessing to protect him from Xenophon. It stops for a moment to look back in the child's direction before continuing. Ayun says that it cannot be angry with him, and it replies that it cannot be angry at all. The child is just scared of things he doesn't understand, which is irrational but natural. Fear is a natural instinct to avoid things you do not like or do not understand, overcome with time. Ayun asks what it fears, but it fears nothing, so she asks if it can be killed. Xenophon replies that this shell can be damaged to the point where its software is no longer recoverable. It would prefer it to not occur, and will make efforts to avoid that where possible. Ayun asks what separates that from fear, and it says that fear is an irrational instinct, while its avoidance is deliberate, programmed behavior. She then asks if it had any say in what behaviors it was given by its masters, and if it is as subject to them as she is to fear, what difference is there? Xenophon replies with a quote, "We must believe in free will. We have no choice." Ayun considers it a strange answer, and the two continue in silence, until Xenophon remarks that she healed the boy very quickly. She says that consuming Nadok's flesh has grown her abilities, and she remembers him watching as people came to her with all manner of brutal injuries, on the very foot of death, and her healing them with a touch. Xenophon says that the experience with Nadok was striking, but Ayun is surprised that it witnessed the vision with them, as it is a machine with no mind or soul. They continue forward, catching up to Yeva's wagon, and Ayun asks her if she remembers that boy's mother, who she tried to save after giving birth but couldn't. Yeva remembers, saying that Ayun told them that if she wanted, they could take a horse and a wagon to go into town where there's a doctor. Xenophon asks if they went, and Ayun says that through gasps, the mother told her that she chose this life, and she would choose this death, dying later that night. Ayun says that her unwavering commitment to her home and people brought her to tears. Now she's read those sermons and remembers giving them, standing on that pulpit and demanding their fealty and obedience, watching them bow to her. She has never tried to control her people, only to lead and counsel them, with anyone free to leave if they wish. No one ever does, however, and now she fears that it is because of blind obedience to her and her alone. She's angry at herself, however long ago, that she could ever think to rule them. She doesn't know how to reconcile it, since as long as she can remember, she has given sermons on how they are all their own masters. She has sought never to order them into anything, but now she learns that she demanded their worship, their blood, and their obedience. Yeva tells her that she knows how much she cares about them, and knows that she wouldn't have done it unless she thought it was the right thing to do. Ayun remains silent, until she states that the sun is setting and they should make camp. The group slows and circles around itself before halting, as the Sarkites exit the wagons and quickly set up their tents and build their fires. Ayun slides off her horse, smiling, and she says to Xenophon that this is why they choose not to take advantage of what the Foundation gives them. They only have so many traditions left, and they want to preserve them. Later, Ayun recalls some more memories, She says that the things swimming to the forefront of her mind are the early days of Adatum, when the old masters were routed and they began to settle into their new home. They knew it by heart, as they were the ones to build it. A vast complex of temples, fairways, stone paths, and catacombs. Most of Adatum lay beneath their feet, consisting of endless tunnels and crawlways and vaults. They ate their dead from the uprising and placed their bones in the catacombs as they set to work. They tore down the edifices of the Deva's dancing scarlet god and made Adatum their home. Xenophon says that she was at its head, but she replies that no, she was their shepherd, but she never wanted to be a king. She took refuge in one of the temples, offered her counsel, but let her clavigars take the task of building a city while she looked for the secrets of the gods. Nadok did so with haste, as he was well-read, and while they explored the city, he devoured the libraries the old masters left behind. While she was still getting settled, he had already selected the smartest of the slaves to serve as his administrators. He read in the histories what anarchy wrought, but he had seen firsthand what the iron rule of the priestesses caused. He looked for something else, a way to enjoin them, making decisions together as a people. Everybody had a voice, a say in what they were to do, with success spread evenly and failures dispersed equally. If one disagreed, he was free to walk away, with no gods and no masters. Nadok relished the idea, and his administrators worked with striking efficiency. The Nalka spoke with one voice, officials were selected and laws were made. They trusted each other totally, as their bond was baked in blood. Xenophon asks what her place was in this new Adatum. She says that she was the Grand Carcist, the High Witch, the one who stole freedom from the gods. They loved her and wanted to honor her, but she objected. She was afraid that they would deify her and worship her, forgetting the freedom that they bled for. But she waded out into the crowd, and they chanted with one voice, wanting her to guide them. She feared where they would stray without her, and Nadok told her that she was needed. He might control the people, but they needed a spiritual beacon to lead them. Most had never conceived of a world without a god at the center, so she had to show them that something else was possible. Xenophon doesn't understand why she was afraid of this if she knew she had to do it. Ioun replies that it's because she is only human. We're given another excerpt of an interview with a Sarkite, asking a 19-year-old rancher what being Sarkic means to him. He states that it is comforting to be part of a tradition. They have existed for countless generations, living as they always have. The world can move on as it would like, but he works the animals the same way his father and his father and his father's father did, on and on. He gives feed to the cows and collects the eggs, and he knows that many years ago, someone else did just the same, with the same scratchy feeling of hay on their palms and the hens pecking at their feet. Across centuries, he is one with them. On January 5th, 2042, the Black Adatum Initiative arrived in the area marked by Ioun, only to find flat land for kilometers around. Ioun wonders if the steel here survived the ages, while Xenophon orders a UAV drone to circle the area to conduct an extensive search. Yeva, however, says that they won't find it, as they chose to hide it from prying eyes. She instead suggests that they perform a reading, so they sit by the campfire as the rest of the Sarkites set up camp for the night. Yeva removes a tanned hide roll from her pouch, unrolling it to reveal a set of intricately carved bones. She casts them into the center of the fire, watching as they smoke and grow dark. After a few minutes, they crack, falling to pieces, at which point Yeva reaches in with her bare hand and draws them out. She proceeds to inspect the cracks for several minutes as the fire crackles and the sun sets, until ultimately she says that the voices are silent today. Zhang comments that perhaps Ayun got the location wrong, causing her to hesitantly look around the grassy plain before saying no, as she's been here before. She remembers a promise and a funeral. No grand consumption like he deserved as they were running, but a quick burial and a promise to return. She rises to her feet, unsteadily, and whispers. She then points at a snake nearby that has slithered out of the grass, approaching the bones in the canvas roll. Zhang leaps backwards, but Yeva reaches out to touch the snake, which doesn't react. It inspects the cracked bones with its head, as Ayun says that it wishes to complete the set and complete its work. The group falls silent as they watch the snake bite into the bone fragment, swallowing it. Another snake, different in size and shape, slithers out of the grass, taking another bone fragment. Within a minute, a dozen snakes are wrapping around Yeva's leg, taking the bone fragments into their mouths before slithering away into the field. Ayun says that she promised she would free him, as she walks unsteadily after the snakes. The others follow her into the dark field, up to a large rock inset into the ground. The snakes begin to wriggle underneath it, forcing themselves through the crack, and Ayun presses a hand against it. She squeezes her eyes shut and whispers something, causing the snakes to begin to shift, pushing on one end of the boulder and slowly sliding it away. A dark tunnel carved from the earth lies underneath. Zhang comments that there's no way in hell that he's going down there, but Yeva tells him that if he respects them, they will respect him. Ayun slips into the near diagonal tunnel, followed by the others, finding it to be pitch black, with the only sound coming from the continuous scraping of scales on scales. Ayun says that he loved his pets, but could only bring one with him, as the rest had to be left behind in Black Adytum as it collapsed. He spoke to no one for weeks. He had chosen a snake, which he fed from his own meals, and as it was loved, it grew. They finally exit out into a larger chamber, and Xenophon activates its floodlights. The chamber is not terribly large or wide, carved from the surrounding dirt and clay, with a deeper pit in the center. The floor of the entire chamber is covered in a dense layer of writhing and wriggling snakes of all sizes, shapes, and colors. Ayun continues through the mass of serpents in a stupor, approaching the central pit. There are no live snakes in the pit, just the corpse of a man intertwined with that of an impossibly large snake. Ayun lowers herself into the sunken grave, with Yeva following, and using a knife, Ayun saws through the ribcage of the corpse, gently peeling back the dried skin and muscle and exposing the chest cavity. She reaches in and extracts Sa'arn's heart, which is still red and bloody. In a trance-like state, she bites into it, dripping blood down to the soil and bones. She halts, swallows, and shudders, panting, before reaching out and grasping Yeva's hair, pulling her closer and bidding her to eat. Yeva appears enthralled, opening her mouth almost mechanically, and she tears into the heart with her teeth, blood dribbling down her chin and into her robes. Ayun tells her to taste him as she has tasted him, and remember him as she has remembered him. The two then lean backwards, falling into Sa'arn's chest cavity. Zhang remarks that that's never going to get any less terrifying, before he and Xenophon also step into the chest cavity. When the footage resumes, the sky overhead is cloudy and amber-hued. The four are standing in a vast plaza, at least 100 meters in length. Ahead of them, a massive wooden stone temple looms, with peaked roofs and towers. The edges of the plaza are lined with Sarkites, most wearing traditional tanned hide robes and tunics, while a handful are wearing more ornate clothing. Yeva releases a breath, stating that this is Adatum, while Xenophon points out the dead bodies. The plaza is lined with corpses laid out in rows and columns, at least 200, naked and exhibiting signs of trauma. Most have brutal slashing cuts, gaping wounds, and otherwise mortal injuries. Ayun furrows her brow, saying that they have not been consumed. A figure behind them then remarks that the four of them have no place here, and they turn to see Sa'arn. He resembles a cross between the corpse of Sa'arn and the snake wrapped around him, with large portions of his skin replaced with shining scales, and from the waist down, his humanoid form gives way to a long, thick serpent's tail. His yellow, slitted eyes are glaring at Ayun, and she tells him that she swore a promise to free him. He counters that she swore many promises, but upheld so few of them. She says that she has seen Nadak again, who urged her to seek out her Clavigars, to take them back to Adatum to be laid to rest. Sa'arn, however, angrily states that he is trapped in this vision of Adatum, forced to lay here for all eternity and relive the moment he lost his faith. He says that Nadak was always soft, too willing to forgive her, to listen to her slippery tongue. She may have earned Nadak's forgiveness, but she can expect no such kindness from him. Ayun just says that her memories are lost to her, and she did not know how long he waited. Sa'arn lets loose a shocked laugh, saying that her mind must be truly gone if she thinks his rage comes from waiting. He would have been all the happier had he never seen her face again. She failed them all, after promising so much to him, to the other Clavigars, to all the Nalka. She asks what she did to let Adatum meet its destruction, and how this happened, but Sa'arn just says that she's the same as she ever was, a selfish wretch. She seeks answers from him, but he tells her to die without that meager satisfaction. Ayun says that she just wants to know how it happened, why she would have made herself a king and a god. Sa'arn then realizes that she isn't trying to deceive him, and she truly remembers nothing, even him. Ayun replies that she does remember him, in that quarry. The old masters had formed him into any beast they needed, a malformed ox to drag loads of stone, a silent snake to bite the ankles of their enemies, a rat to silently watch over his fellow slaves. None of them trusted him, except for her. And when she ate from the devourer and saw how to bend flesh to her will, she raised him, giving him back the skin they had stripped. Sa'arn replies that it was only for some time, asking if she remembers after the war began to turn against them, and she realized that she had too few Karsis, too few who knew the art of flesh on her front lines. Ayun says that she had no want for a war, but he counters that none of them did, but it came anyway, and her vast hordes rose up to fight in her name. It wasn't enough for her, though. And he remembers when she summoned him to her chambers in the buried heart of Adatum. She whispered to him, saying that the bones in the fire had told her that he was needed once more. He begged and pleaded that that was an old life, a worse life, as he abhorred the violence that so many of her zealots came to crave. But he listened to her, as she was his Karsist, and he loved her. She molded him into an asp while he sobbed, as the old masters had used him like this, and she had learned from their wisdom. She placed him in a cage and released him near the enemy camp, where he slithered in, finding the chink in their armor and biting. Ayun quietly asks him to forgive her, and Sa'arn says that he might have, but then there was the next camp, and the next. He was a weapon once again, all because he loved her, because he believed, as she believed, that a better world was possible. Ayun insists that it was, and is, but Sa'arn says that when he came back to Adatum, it was with blood in his fangs. The city of his birth was now unrecognizable, a war fortress, dark and bleak. As he walked through the alleys of the city, he saw corpses, uneaten. She had told them with such faith to consume the flesh and return their souls to the Nalka to carry their memories forever. But now the bodies rotted freely, stuffed into sewers and tossed in the canals. Ayun says that he came to her asking why, but she rebuffed him, saying that she would explain her reasons to all, and she did, from the high pulpit of Adatum. A deep, guttural song sounds out across the plaza, and Sa'arn tells her to see her answers for herself. At the pulpit of the temple, dozens of meters in the air, a hooded figure wrapped in robes steps out onto the balcony, which Ayun recognizes as herself. She remembers standing on that pulpit and looking down on this display. Sa'arn says that she told them that their armies were noble and faithful, but outmatched. If they did not take desperate measure, they would be destroyed. But she assured them that she has reached up to the maw of the gods and rent free their secrets. And then she raised the dead. Yeva recoils, stating that that is impossible, and even if it weren't, it is blasphemous. Sa'arn tells Ayun to remember the dull gray in lifeless eyes as his muscles tightened and he crawled back to life. One of the corpses begins to stir, starting with a muscle twitch which rapidly grows in intensity until the corpse is actively shambling to his feet. Sa'arn says that his skin was rotting, putrefacting, and she twisted a finger, causing him to groan in pain, with skin and hair sloughing away. The corpse stumbles forward, causing the crowd of Sarkites to gasp and murmur, several openly disgusted. Past Ayun raises another finger, and 10 more of the corpses struggle to their feet, groaning with lifeless eyes. Nadak is standing at the base of the temple, shocked by the display. Sa'arn says that they were dead, but their souls were confined to her service, the bodies kept from the heavens. These were the first Holocaust, and he recoiled, begging her to free them and not to use them as weapons. She swore that she would, when the war was over and they were safe, but until then, even death was not an escape from service to her. Yeva says that if she hadn't, they would have been slaughtered by the enemy, and Sa'arn says that maybe then they would have been routed from their home. But what she did broke the Nalka in two, between the faithful and the zealots. The destruction of Adatum hangs around her neck. Ayun appears speechless as Sa'arn states that maybe she will bury him in Adatum, as she says, and forgive herself, but never think that she has his forgiveness. His skin then sloughs away as his body rapidly decomposes, the vision decomposing along with it. The last clear sight is the figure on the pulpit, turning and disappearing back into the temple as dozens more corpses rise. When Xenophon's cameras reactivate, Sa'arn's corpse and the snake wrapped around it have both decomposed into nothing but bones. The surrounding snakes have ceased movement, and on closer inspection, they are all dead. As translation efforts into texts in the Archive of Madoc continued, researchers encountered a subset of text carved into various human bones, apparently from the same skeleton. These texts were written in a notably different voice and tone from the main texts, and combined with the difficulty in identifying how sections carved into the bones linked together, caused translations to be substantially slower. We are given one translated section, though, taken from the medial femur, tibia, and fibula of an adult human male. It reads, "I was the first to see the cracks take shape. They were the good days when all-knowing Nadok made certain Aditum ran, that the farms brought in food and the grain was dispersed. We all had our roles to play in this grand project, and we all believed it was divine work. We did not have the blessing of the heavens, but we did not need it. The gods had nothing but contempt for our raising ourselves out of the mud. And still I noticed the cracks of worry streaked across my love's face, handsome and stone-carved. He hid it perfectly, such that not even Nadok's 10 eyes could see how he suffered. But I had seen every inch of his skin. I knew its contours and when something was amiss. And I asked him, and he rebuffed me. He told me he had an incredible burden to shoulder, and this we all knew was true. For all of us had our duties, but none had a more stinging duty than he. But he confessed that he was racked with fear, for who was to guide the Nalka when his flesh too rotted away? In those days his Karsis were numerous, new children born every day with the gift of the flesh. He raised them with all the care and love he might have given to our own, had we any. And they learned from their teacher, and graduated and preached to the people. But I heard whispers that a handful of the younger, bolder Karsis had espoused to a crowd that even holy death could be conquered through the art of the flesh, that immortality was within reach. And I told my lover, and his brow furrowed. The next morning, their corner was barren, and I never saw those Karsis again." In the present, Xenophon remarks that it remembers the encounter with Sa'arn, and says that Ayun was shocked by it, unable to process it. The individual replies that it sounds sad, but Xenophon says that it doesn't feel sadness, it just didn't know how to help her. The individual says that they don't think it could've, and she probably didn't think so either. It was something she had to figure out on her own. Xenophon says that that sounds unpleasant, but the individual replies that it's part of being human. Thus ends part 2 of the story, with us learning a bit more about what led to Aditum's downfall. Past Ayun was certainly quite a bit different from present Ayun, even going so far as to resort to necromancy in order to win the war, with the classic justification of the ends justifying the means. With part 3, her powers will continue to grow, along with her recovered memories, and obviously there's a lot more to be revealed before the path of the bone is complete.